Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're talking about a Japanese sword that somehow always ends up in the shadows.
The wakizashi. And that's actually kind of crazy, isn't it? Everyone knows the katana. It's the quintessential samurai sword. But the wakizashi?
Yet they belong together like, well, like bread and butter, you could say.
That's an important point. Together they form what's called the daisho. That was the sword pair of the samurai class, and from the Edo period onward, around 1600, it became the status symbol of the samurai. Only they were allowed to wear the pair, although sometimes townspeople were permitted to carry a wakizashi, depending on the context.
And the wakizashi wasn't just a small backup weapon, it had its own distinct purposes. With a blade length of 30 to 60 centimeters, it was perfect for situations where the long katana simply became impractical.
Imagine a castle, narrow corridors, low ceilings. You're not going to draw a sword with a 70-centimeter blade in there. The wakizashi, on the other hand, fast, agile, precise.
The way it was worn was also different, which I find fascinating. Unlike the older tachi, which hung with the blade facing down, both the katana and wakizashi were worn with the blade facing up.
So you could draw it faster?
For quick access in close combat. In confined spaces, every second counts. And if you're being attacked, you don't want to awkwardly
have to rotate the sword. That makes total sense.
And for this reason, the wakizashi was also the weapon a samurai almost always had on him, even indoors. The katana would be set aside in certain situations, but the wakizashi?
It was basically a constant companion. Interesting. And then there was the ceremonial aspect.
You mean the thing nobody likes to talk about?
Seppuku, yes. The ritual suicide. The wakizashi was often used for that, sometimes a tanto as well, depending on the era. But it also had other ceremonial functions. It was a sword of honor, a symbol of a samurai's duties.
What has always fascinated me is the craftsmanship. Because the wakizashi was not some cheap, smaller sword.
Right. It was forged with
typically the same techniques as the katana.
The same elaborate process. The steel, called tamahagane, was extracted from iron sand. It was smelted in a traditional furnace called a tatara. One cycle took 3 days and three nights.
And then the yield. From 2.5 tons of iron sand and 12 tons of charcoal, you'd end up with only about 900 kilos of usable tamahagane. And only about a fifth of that was top quality.
That was then sorted, the best pieces selected, and then came the folding. Heating, folding, hammering, over and over again. This process removed impurities and distributed the carbon evenly.
And this creates that characteristic pattern in the blade, the hada. Like a, almost like wood grain, but in steel.
Perfect comparison. Each blade became unique through this process. And this quality applied equally to both swords. The wakizashi was no compromise.
I'm curious. In today's reenactment scene, you often see the daisho, both swords together.
That's actually a sign of authenticity. If you want to portray a classic samurai concept, especially from the Edo period, you really need both. The katana alone, it just seems incomplete, as if half of the samurai identity is missing.
Although I have to say, many people focus on the katana first. The wakizashi comes later.
Understandable. But anyone who really engages with samurai culture quickly realizes the wakizashi deserves just as much attention. It was practical, symbolic, and crafted at the highest level.
And it has a fascinating history in the media as well. But we'll get to that shortly.
That's going to be interesting, because the way film and television portray the wakizashi says a lot about cultural differences.
What I find particularly captivating about this era is how Japanese cinema in the 50s and 60s brought the wakizashi to the screen.
The golden age of the samurai film.
And not simply as a prop, but as a genuine narrative element. In 1954, Akira Kurosawa created something with Seven Samurai that changed the entire film world.
Over 3 hours of film, and every minute of it groundbreaking for what came after.
The attention to detail in this film is remarkable. How the weapons are handled, how the daisho is worn, the combat techniques. Kurosawa studied historical sources extensively. Sure, cinematic drama came first, but you can see the research behind it. Far more care than Western productions of the time.
You need to distinguish between two terms here, jidaigeki and chambara. Jidaigeki is the broader historical genre, period drama essentially. It covers everything set in the feudal era.
Revenge stories, detective stories, the lives of famous swordsmen. A very wide range.
And chambara, that's...
The sword film. The word comes from chanchan barabara, which is the Japanese onomatopoeia for clashing blades.
Perfect. So every chambara is a jidaigeki, but not the other way around.
And chambara focuses on dynamic fight scenes. The choreography was the central element, precise movements based on real martial arts.
What makes these films so special is the balance. Historical accuracy meets artistic vision. They didn't just improvise the staging.
You can see this particularly well in Kurosawa's work. The fights aren't long and spectacular like they later became in Hollywood. They're short, brutal, decisive. One sword stroke and it's over.
And this exact style revolutionized international cinema. Sergio Leone used Kurosawa's Yojimbo as the template for A Fistful of Dollars.
And Seven Samurai became...
The Magnificent Seven, with Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen.
Seven mismatched fighters protecting a village. The concept works anywhere, whether with samurai or cowboys.
George Lucas later admitted that Kurosawa's films massively influenced Star Wars. The question of whether a warrior uses his skills honorably, that's the foundation for the light and dark sides of the Force.
It's really impressive when you consider that it all stems from these samurai films of the 50s.
Speaking of impressive, if you're interested in these kinds of connections, if you want to learn more about the links between history and pop culture, feel free to leave us a like or subscribe to the channel. It really helps us produce more content like this.
But back to the genres. What's fascinating about chambara is that the fights often form the finale. The whole film builds toward it, and then, how should I put it, this release of tension in one short, intense moment.
Completely different from Western action films, where the fights keep getting longer and more elaborate. In classic chambara, sometimes seconds are enough.
The wakizashi has its own distinct role in these films. It comes into play when things get tight, in interior spaces, during surprise attacks. The directors knew exactly when each sword should be used.
The camera teams faced real challenges. Capturing these fast movements, the interplay of both blades during daisho combat, that required entirely new techniques.
The actors sometimes train for months. Toshiro Mifune, Kurosawa's regular leading man, was known for performing fight scenes with an intensity that was almost dangerous.
And has this tradition continued to this day?
The influence is visible everywhere. Every modern action film with swords owes something to Chambara. The way fights are staged, the rhythm, the significance of every single movement. It all comes from this golden age of Japanese cinema.
Now it gets interesting. How does Hollywood handle the wakizashi? And is it really that different from Japan?
The question is more complicated than it sounds. Because it's not simply good versus bad. These are different approaches with different goals.
Take The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise, the film from 2003. You see the wakizashi as part of the samurai equipment. The daisho is shown. But the portrayal, it takes liberties.
The film romanticizes samurai culture quite heavily. The fight scenes are elaborately choreographed, very dramatic. Historically accurate? Not necessarily. But the film got millions of people interested in Japanese history.
That's the thing with Hollywood productions. They tend to...
Hold on, that's too sweeping. There are major differences between productions.
Okay, fair. Where do you see the differences?
Take Kill Bill, for example. Tarantino makes no secret of the fact that he's stylizing. The wakizashi is used as an aesthetic element, not a historical artifact. The fights are exaggerated, the blood fountains absurd. But that's precisely the point.
He pays homage to the chambara genre, but in his own way.
He takes the aesthetic and turns it up to 11. It's not a history lesson, it's an homage. And as such, it works brilliantly.
Then we have 47 Ronin from 2013, right? No, wait, that was also 2013. It's about the historical story of the 47 masterless samurai, but with fantasy elements.
Dragons, witches, supernatural powers. The historical source material is actually one of the most famous samurai stories ever. But the film chose to tell it as a fantasy spectacle.
The ceremonial significance of the wakizashi gets almost lost in the process. In Western productions, it's mainly shown as a combat tool. The deeper cultural dimension, the spiritual connection between warrior and sword, that rarely comes across.
Although there are exceptions. Shogun, for example.
The series?
It consciously strives for authenticity. They worked with Japanese consultants, the actors trained in martial arts. The way the swords are worn, the etiquette, it's respected.
That shows it's possible. Western productions can be culturally respectful.
And that's the crucial point. It's not about historically correct versus wrong. It's about intention.
Does the film want to entertain? Then artistic liberties are legitimate. Does it want to portray a culture? Then it should make the effort.
Kill Bill doesn't want to teach. Kill Bill wants to celebrate. And it does so with full awareness of its exaggerations. 47 Ronin, on the other hand, takes a true story and distorts it.
The difference is particularly clear in the fight choreography. Hollywood goes for long, spectacular sequences. Lots of cuts, lots of moves, maximum action.
And that brings us back to what we saw with Kurosawa. In traditional Japanese productions, a single precise strike is often decisive. The tension builds, and then one movement. It's over.
That requires more attention from the audience. Hollywood makes it easier to consume.
Which isn't automatically worse. These are different storytelling traditions. The question is rather, does the production respect its source? Does it understand what it's adapting?
And a lot has changed in recent years. Streaming services invest in elaborate productions that take time for cultural nuances.
Audiences have become more discerning too. Superficial exoticism doesn't work as well as it used to.
Fans notice when something's off. And they speak up.
Which ultimately helps everyone. the more authentic portrayals there are, the better the general understanding of the culture behind the weapons.
Let's talk about the practical side. How do you even bring the Daisho to the screen?
That's actually one of the biggest challenges in film choreography. You have two swords of different lengths that need to be coordinated simultaneously. The katana with its long blade for distance attacks, the wakizashi for close combat.
And historically, the two blades were rarely drawn at the same time. The wakizashi only came into play when...
when the katana was lost, or the fight got too close. In film, though, you often see both swords in action simultaneously.
Which, of course, looks more spectacular.
Just like with the classics, actors today still have to train for months for such scenes. In major productions, that's sometimes 3 or 4 months of intensive sword training before the first fight scene is even shot.
That long?
The body has to automate the movements. You can't think about every step when the camera's rolling. The muscles have to know what to do.
That's the difference from stage combat. On a theater stage, you have distance from the audience. Small inaccuracies go unnoticed.
In film, the camera is often right there. Close-ups, slow motion, different angles, everything gets captured. Every wrong hand position, every sloppy swing is visible.
And these close-ups also need to work without looking chaotic or confusing.
That requires precise coordination between the stunt team and camera operators. They know beforehand exactly which strike will be filmed from which angle. Sometimes individual movements are shot in isolation and edited together later.
With the historical Daisho techniques, the interplay of the
blades was highly codified. There were specific schools that laid out precisely when each sword should be used and how.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
The Nitoryu school of Miyamoto Musashi is the most famous example. He systematized fighting with two swords. There are both sequences and simultaneous use, though it was an uncommon style overall.
In film, all of this has to be condensed. Stunt coordinators take these traditional fundamentals and, how do you say it, translate them for the camera.
They create a bridge between historical martial arts and cinematic impact.
Camera angles play a central role in this. A strike coming directly at the camera looks much more dynamic than one from the side. The editing rhythm determines the pace of the scene. And special effects can emphasize movements or make them look dangerous when they're not.
How much authenticity is left after all that?
That's the eternal question. A real Daisho fight would probably be anticlimactic for viewers. Too fast, too short, too subtle. Film needs drama.
So the best productions find a good balance. The fundamental principles remain recognizable, but are adapted for modern viewing habits.
With Shogun, which we mentioned earlier, they worked with Japanese sword masters. The movements are clearly well-founded, even if they were optimized for the camera.
That requires a deep understanding from everyone involved. The stunt coordinators need to know traditional martial arts, the actors need to have internalized them, and the camera operators need to know what they should capture.
It's a collaborative process. If one element doesn't work, the whole scene falls apart. The precision has to be right at every level.
In the end, a good Daisho scene is the result of months of preparation, technical know-how, and respect for the tradition behind it.
That's also why we watch certain fight scenes over and over again. Because we can sense the real work that went into them. Now we come to an area that's personally close to my heart. Anime, manga, and video games.
That's where the wakizashi has gone through its own unique evolution over the past few decades.
Let's start with manga and anime. Rurouni Kenshin is a classic there. The story is set in the Meiji era, so the late 19th century, and the protagonist fights with a reversed sword.
A sakabato, with the cutting edge facing inward.
The research behind it particularly impressed me. The mangaka, Nobuhiro Watsuki, studied historical sword techniques extensively. The combat movements are based on real schools of Japanese swordsmanship.
That's reminiscent of the attention to detail in classic Jidaigeki films. There too, authentic portrayal was the priority.
Vagabond goes even further. The manga tells the life of Miyamoto Musashi, and the depiction of combat techniques is almost textbook precise.
Takehiko Inoue invested years in research. The panels show movement sequences you can actually study.
What makes anime and manga so interesting is that they can show things that wouldn't be possible in film. Slow motion within a movement, inner monologues during combat, the visualization of technique and strategy.
The medium allows a depth of explanation that live action can never achieve. You don't just see the strike, you understand it.
And then came Ghost of Tsushima, 2020, a game that changed everything.
The development team at Sucker Punch
put in an incredible amount of effort. They worked with historians, sword masters, Japanese cultural consultants.
And you can see the result in every detail. The way Jin Sakai draws his sword, his stance, his footwork.
What's special about games is you do it yourself. You execute the movements. You decide on the technique. That's a completely different approach than passive viewing.
There are reports of players who started getting interested in real martial arts after Ghost of Tsushima. Iaido classes, kendo training.
Nioh, Sekiro, Way of the Samurai, the Tenchu series. There are so many games that explore Japanese swordsmanship.
And the developers take it seriously. Motion capture with real martial artists, consultants for historical accuracy, sometimes years of development just for the combat system.
It's fascinating that these media reach people who would never watch a Kurosawa film. Teenagers who suddenly develop an interest in Japanese history through a video game.
The wakizashi becomes a gateway. You play, you get curious, you research, and suddenly you're reading about the Edo period.
Ghost of Tsushima even has a Kurosawa mode. Black and white, with film grain, Japanese audio track. A direct bow to classic samurai cinema.
That brings it full circle. From the films of the 50s to the games of today, the fascination remains the same.
The symbolic dimension isn't lost either. In the best games and anime, the wakizashi is more than a weapon. It represents choices, morality, the character's inner journey.
Whether Jin Sakai in Ghost of Tsushima chooses between honor and pragmatism, or Kenshin defends his vow of non-violence, the sword is always also a symbol.
And that's what makes these media so powerful. They entertain, but they also impart knowledge. Sometimes, without you even realizing it.
When we look at what the wakizashi has become in media, it's far more than a prop.
It's a storytelling tool. Directors and writers use it to define their characters.
In the best productions, the wakizashi represents inner strength, moral fortitude. When a character draws the short sword, it's rarely just about the fight.
These are the moments of decision. Honor versus survival, duty versus personal happiness. The wakizashi becomes a symbol for these inner conflicts.
And it works because the weapon carries this history within it. Centuries of tradition, of meaning. The audience senses that, even without knowing the details.
The streaming era has changed quite a bit.
Netflix, Amazon, Apple, they invest in elaborate samurai productions. And they take time for the details.
What used to be considered niche now reaches
a global audience, millions of viewers worldwide.
And they expect quality. They've played Ghost of Tsushima. They've seen Shogun. Superficial portrayals don't work anymore.
That forces productions to take more care. Historical consultants, martial arts experts, cultural sensitivity. It's becoming the standard.
A kind of, how should I put it, a cycle is forming. Better portrayals lead to a more informed audience, which in turn demands better portrayals.
Awareness of authentic Japanese culture is growing. Not just for the weapons, but for the entire philosophy behind them.
The connection between traditional knowledge and modern storytelling is the key. The best works respect history while telling it in a way that works today.
And in doing so, they preserve cultural heritage. Young people who come to the wakizashi through a video game or anime carry this knowledge forward.
That's the beautiful thing about it. A tradition that's centuries old finds new ways to survive.
Through media that didn't exist 50 years ago.
If I'm asked which portrayal means the most to me, honestly, it's hard to say. Kurosawa's classics have this timeless quality.
But Ghost of Tsushima affected me more emotionally, because I was part of the story myself.
And that illustrates how diverse the path of discovery have become. There's no right way to explore this culture.
Whether through film, game, manga, or yes, even through a podcast like this one.
That brings us to the end of this episode. We hope you've gained a new perspective on the wakizashi. This small sword that's so much more than just a backup weapon.
If you want to dive deeper, check out battlemerchant.com. There you'll find not only an extensive selection of Japanese swords and equipment, but also the blog with many more topics for history enthusiasts.
Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.